Hello, I'm Richard Kilgariff. Welcome to the Bokomi podcast, getting smarter, faster, together with original, memorable insights. OMI, from the most wanted new books across business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode, we look at the misleading nature of numbers with the numbers correspondent from The Correspondent, a groundbreaking community of journalists and readers committed to unbreaking news.
I'm Sonne Blau, the author of The Number Bias, and this is my OMI for Bokomi.
Sonne Blau has grown up loving numbers and their effect on people. She has a BSc and a PhD in econometrics from the Erasmus University in Rotterdam.
The number bias stands for the fact that we tend to trust numbers much more easily than we do words, because somehow we think numbers are the conveyors of some objective truth.
Her new book, The Number Bias, How Numbers Lead Us and Mislead Us, is a timely survey of correlations and causations which shed light on some of the big issues facing us today. Sonne, welcome to Bokomi.
Hi, Richard.
You say you were a numbers nerd as a child. Did this cut you off from other people or connect you to them?
Well, I was really into numbers at a young age, actually. I remember that my grandparents bought me this digital clock, and I remember not being able to sleep at night and making calculations with the numbers. So that's one of my early memories, and that just went on. I loved maths. I went on to study econometrics, which is a combination of economics and statistics. And now I'm actually writing about numbers, and I made my job into showing people that numbers are actually fun and not a reason to cut other people off.
No.
So in fact, I seem to be able to convince more and more people that numbers are interesting and are interesting to read about as well, like my book.
Well, the oldest surviving book from some 4,000 years ago in Mesopotamia, I think it was, contained symbols of measurements for crops. So the first recorded writer was an accountant, as Yuval Harari points out in his book as well. Is this where our obsession with measurement and numbers began? Because as societies grew, we needed to share information to write everything down?
That's it. That's exactly it. Because as you can imagine, if you live in small communities, it's pretty easy to still remember everything, right? If someone borrows something from you, or if you have to remember where the nice berries are, anything. But then as community grew into villages, into cities, into nation states, and now we're even working together at a worldwide scale, obviously, it's very hard to note all that knowledge down. And I think a very important part of that is numbers, because a lot of our relationships consist of things that we can quantify. The most important one, obviously, is money. At one point, we started using money to keep record of our relationships and what we owed each other. So I think numbers are a very important tool to work together at a large scale, not only to understand the world, but also to somehow control it. I think the rise of numbers, you mentioned this very old document, which obviously it's actually a document by the first person that we actually know by name, which is interesting. But then we saw a whole other development around, I think it was kind of in the 19th century, when nation states became much more powerful and they had to start collecting taxes as well. And how can you collect taxes on something like land or on something like a product if you don't have a measure for distance or for mass? So there you see that actually numbers and measures, so things that we invent in order to quantify certain concepts, were very important in also control. And that's control of the nation state over a population, but obviously it also goes the other way around. I mean, in well-functioning democracies, we use numbers to hold our leaders accountable, which is why, for instance, now in Brazil, the country the president has decided not to publish corona figures anymore, which I think is deeply disturbing. So that's kind of a quick history of numbers, which started millennia ago. But then recently we've seen kind of a surge in our use of numbers.
Yeah, you mentioned control.
Yes.
And the use of numbers to control and explain and communicate. And in your book, you explain how the need to record everything, to measure and control, continued through the centuries from the Doomsday Book to the Industrial Revolution, and then something big happened, bar charts and analysis, what historian Stephen Stigler refers to as the statistical enlightenment around 1900. What happened? What changed everything?
Well, like I said, there, like we started working together at larger scales with more needs to control. So this nation state that really led to a surge in recording of numbers, the Enlightenment as well. But then we had all these numbers, but then what are you going to do with them, right? You can record a ton of numbers, but then how do you understand what they mean? How do you actually analyze the patterns in them? And that's when this period that Stigler calls the statistical enlightenment started, where we started thinking of ways to make sense of these piles and piles of numbers that we were collecting. And a bit earlier, we started using averages. We started using graphics. I think a big example in my book is Florence Nightingale, who is one of my heroes as well, and who was also a number nerd, by the way, but that not a lot of people know that. But she actually used infographics to convince her country's leaders to have more hygiene in military hospitals. And then later on came more and more complex statistical methods. And that's the development that goes on until today, right? I mean, today we have machine learning and we have more and more complex methods to analyze that big pile of data, because, you know, numbers are only useful if you can actually have a way to interpret them.
And that usefulness has obviously helped us develop a society, technology, culture. But have we relied too heavily on numbers and statistics to represent the truth? And to begin with, numbers help to keep rulers in check, as you say. But what happens when the ownership of data falls into the hands of people who want to use it for their own ends? And I'm thinking of eugenics in the 20s and 30s, and more recently, politicians trying to win votes or deal with a pandemic, like say in Brazil, or climate change.
Yeah, I mean, that's my book is called The Number Bias. And I think the number bias stands for the fact that we tend to trust numbers much more easily than we do words, because somehow we think numbers are the conveyors of some objective truth. And in a way, I mean, they are very useful to understand the world better. But because we've been using numbers more and more, the incentive to abuse them has become bigger as well. And there are plenty of examples about that throughout the ages. Like you say, using numbers, for instance, in the book I mentioned, a very big exercise in the United States where 1.75 million recruits had to fill out an intelligence test. And it turned out that Black men scored very low and immigrants as well. And that was in turn being used as evidence that they should have more strict immigrant laws. And that's one of those examples I explain in the book why those numbers were very tainted. The methods were very messy, and there are a lot of reasons why you would find those results, even if you had the right methods, that had nothing to do with some innate inferiority. But that shows that throughout the ages, we've also used numbers to support a certain opinion. And sometimes that can be terrible, like you see in the eugenics movement. On the other hand, we also see that numbers are being used to show, for instance, inequality between men and women, or between white people and other minorities. So I think that's a good thing to remember. Whereas we think numbers are so objective, they are often used by people with motivations, whether they are good or bad. And that's something that influences our use of numbers. And we shouldn't forget when we see numbers in the news or somewhere else.
Well, I love your use of language, and it's translated, isn't it, from Dutch?
Yes, exactly.
Your book, but it's been translated beautifully because there's some great metaphors. You say numbers are like soap, squeeze them too hard and they slip through your fingers. What do you mean by that?
Well, I refer here to something that's called Goodhart's Law. And it's a law that says once a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. And it means once you focus so much on a certain number and on attaining a certain threshold for that number, the incentive to abuse it is very big. And I think we recently saw it in the UK with where I think it was the health secretary who promised 100,000 tests per day for corona. And then he made his target. But as it turned out, they sent out a lot of home kits, which, you know, were basically tests, but you know, didn't really count as that, but he did his did make his 100,000 threshold. So that's just one of the examples where Goodhart's law applies. And I think once you start looking for it, you see it a lot. I think in business, you see a lot of targets, and then people want to make that target so badly that they start behaving in a way that's not actually beneficial to the company. I remember in the Netherlands, our police at one point had targets for the amount of fines they gave out. So they organized so-called fine days on which they would give as many fines as they could for really stupid little things just to make their targets. So that's what I mean by, you know, they are like soap. If you squeeze these numbers so hard because you want them to be something, then the incentive for kind of unuseful and sometimes even dangerous behavior is quite big.
Yeah, we have a penchant for sticking numbers on the sides of buses to persuade people to
yes.
vote for certain causes.
I remember that, yes.
But do we find comfort in numbers, though? Because this happens a lot with tribes and statistics and numbers, that we use them to our own ends, that we know they're not true. We know that they're kind of made up, but we want to believe in them. So we use them as a kind of milestone or a light to follow. That's what I find fascinating. And I'm not a numbers nerd at all. But I suppose I'm a people nerd. I'm a meaning nerd. And I find it fascinating, and your book fascinating, because you draw out human behavior and our relationship with numbers in a way that is insightful, to the point where we understand why we lie to ourselves.
Yes. Well, I think for a long time, when I've been writing about numbers for years now, and for a long time I thought, if only everyone had enough knowledge about statistics, then it would all be okay, right? But then, you know, after a while, you come to the conclusion, like, you know, even people who know a lot about numbers are deceived by certain numbers and want to believe certain outcomes of quantitative research. And that's why I also have a whole chapter in my book about psychology, because if we understand our relationship to numbers, we have to understand ourselves. And like you say, I mean, numbers have some aura of certainty, which is what we love, especially in modern society. We're so used to having things under control and to have certainty about our future. And by we, I mean, that doesn't go for everyone, but we are used to being in control. And I think, I mean, I've been writing about numbers for years, but never have I seen an obsession with numbers so big as now in the corona crisis. And I think part of the explanation, obviously, is that we want to understand, but part of it is also that we're afraid and we need something to hold on to. So I think there are a lot of very human motivations that have nothing to do with statistics in why we are using numbers.
And there are more numbers, there's more data than ever before.
Yeah.
You talk about big data in the book. Looking at the future, you say, and I quote, "We might even save democracy with big data." What do you mean by that? That data is more reliable than voters? Doesn't that depend on who and what is collecting the data?
Well, I definitely don't believe that. I refer to a Dutch columnist who wrote that down as a thought experiment, saying like, hey, what if in the future we know so much about people that we actually already know what they want and they don't have to vote anymore? But to me, that's a deeply disturbing and dystopian future that I hope we'll never get to. Because I think, I mean, the mistake is that now we have tons of data that all these problems that I describe in the book will somehow magically go away. I write about correlation and causation. I write about samples that are not representative. All these issues are still present, even if we have tons and tons of data. And I think there's one issue that we will always face, which is once we use those numbers in algorithms, we always have to think, what is actually the goal? I give the example of YouTube. Does YouTube want you to get a balanced diet of information? Or does YouTube want to make you watch as long as they can possibly make you watch? Those are two very different goals. And if you use data and use them in an algorithm to build a site that attains one of those two goals, it will look very differently. So I think we have to remember that the purpose that we use numbers for will always be a subjective choice, and thereby never, hopefully never be made by computers, because I think, especially in a democracy, I mean, it's up to us what is the goal of our numbers.
I should know better than to misquote and misrepresent a data scientist, a numbers nerd. I did, I must say, when I highlighted that, I thought, that's a bit punchy.
Yeah. And also very out of line with all the other things.
I thought, she's hidden in some kind of totalitarian message between the lines.
No, but it's interesting, right? How people think big data is going to save us. And I think it's kind of a hope that we can do away with all the messy problems we have and just simply have technology solve it for us. And that's just too easy. It doesn't work like that. Things will always be complicated, will always be messy. We will always disagree with each other because that's how humans work. And I think there, like, this need for big data to solve our very big problems, I think it's yeah, I don't know. It's a bit disturbing to me.
Disturbing and dystopian. And yes. It is messy, but we're always trying to make sense of it. Our brain is trying to put things in order. Yeah. Our society is trying to put things in order. And yet, actually, order is not the thing which moves ideas and creativity and innovation forward. Is that something that you pursue at De Correspondent? It's a really fascinating collection of people and a model you've got there. And a lot of people have talked about it. It's made its way into the UK by osmosis, and like your colleague Rutger Bregman is very high profile. Yeah. What's so special about it as a model that's different to other news organizations?
Well, there are several things. One of the things is that we're completely ad-free, and we have a member-based model, which makes the business model very different. I think another one is that we're based around authors. Because in the philosophy of The Correspondent, essential is there that we don't believe that journalism can ever be objective, because it's also always done from a certain angle. It depends on where you're from, who you are, how you were brought up. And we believe that rather than just hiding that and pretending you're this really objective journalist, it's better just to be transparent about who you are and where you came from. So that's why our platform is really based around authors rather than certain topics, because then you can get to know me and my colleagues and understand why I write what I write. And I think a third big difference is that we are not really a news medium. We're more writing about more structural developments. So to take my beat, for instance, like I could write about this poll that today went wrong, but I find it more interesting to ask, like, why are we as a society so obsessed with numbers, and how can we change that? What does it say about us, and how can we have a different future? So those are three things that are different than if you compare it to other media. And the last one is that we get a lot of freedom. So I can write about whatever I want, which is amazing.
It is amazing. And yes. It's a very new and fresh approach to information and news. It's very people led, isn't it? And you use the phrase unbreaking news, which I quite like.
Yeah. As well. Yeah, definitely. So with that, we refer to like how we don't jump on whatever is in the news today, but try to kind of look like on a bigger, a bit longer term and structural.
And it's available in English translation, just to get the advert out there.
Yeah,
I expect a free subscription, of course. It's available in translation, isn't it, as well?
Yes, we launched. So we have De Correspondent, which is the Dutch platform, and we launched The Correspondent last year. And they're not exactly the same, but we do translate back and forth. So definitely become a member of The Correspondent and. I'll make sure you'll get your free membership.
Oh, don't worry. No, I'm signing up today. And my pleasure to pay.
That's amazing. Thank you.
So how do we protect ourselves then as individuals sitting at home, working from home, traveling between home and work, being a key worker, being a politician. How do we protect ourselves against what you call the dangerous misuse or presentation of numbers? What should we do when we encounter a number or a chart for the first time?
So I think there are a couple of questions you can ask yourself. Well, one thing is just pause and think to yourself, hey, let's not trust this number blindly. Also not disregard it right away, but hey, let's be curious about this number and see where it comes from. I think one very important question to always ask yourself is, who is the messenger here? Who is telling me this number? And what is his or her incentive? If there's a certain politician coming out with this number that's really big in his favor, if there's a scientist who has been supporting a certain direction of the measures and then magically comes with some outcome that supports his political views. I mean, those are important things to know. But another thing, and this is even before you go into the methods, is to look at yourself and think, hey, what do I feel? Does this number make me happy? Does it support what I already believe? Does it go against my beliefs? And do I then, you know, have the urge not to believe it right away? So also look at yourself and maybe try to see if there are any biases you have about this specific number. Because we tend to be much more emotional about numbers that matter to us than numbers about, you know, skin cream or whatever. So if you've done that, then look into the number. Is it a poll? Ask yourself, was this the sample for this poll collected such that it's representative? Is it a graph? Ask yourself, hey, are the X's the way they should be? Is it maybe a claim about correlation and causality? So like, you know, you see a lot of news about nutrition, like eat avocados, drink wine or whatever. And ask yourself, hey, maybe they mixed up correlation with causality. Could there be other explanations for this relationship? So ask yourself a lot of questions. I think that's the right thing to do. And I could imagine that you think, yeah, but hey, I don't have time to really think about every number I see in a newspaper in this deeply. I understand that. So try to look, if you're curious, try to look for good fact checks, for instance, or just accept that you might not know for sure whether this number is right or not. But for the numbers that really matter to your life, I think it really pays off to delve deeper and to also stay curious and keep looking for more information.
And what's your favorite number, Sonna?
Can I guess? Yes.
Well, the stats would say it's 7.
I know, but I don't like 7. I mean, it is a prime number, which is kind of cool. You know, you gotta love prime numbers. Prime numbers are numbers that can only be divided by themselves or by one. But I kind of like even numbers. And I always choose 24 because my birthday is October 24th.
If I'd known your birthday, I would have gone for that as well.
Egocentric.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Very revealing there, Sonna. Revealing in your favorite number. Well, listen, you are by far the number one best numbers correspondent I have ever met. And also my number one favorite author of The Numbers Bias. Thanks for talking to us on the Bookomi podcast today.
Thank you so much. You're my favorite, Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Sonna Blau's book, The Number Bias, How Numbers Lead and Mislead Us, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction before anyone else, you can join our most wanted community at bookomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bookomi pod, please let us know by following or subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Stay safe and remember, numbers don't count for anything without human beings. Bye for now.